You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we're jam-packed. First up, Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund on the seven huge cases the Supreme Court will decide this month that could change America. Also, we'll talk about why we shouldn't trust the Supreme Court. And then, talking about some major progressive victories in House primaries last night. Founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Adam Green, will be joining us. And of course, later in the program, the results from, or some of them, I guess, from the primaries last night. You're not going to believe who's still going to be around for a while. Here's a hint. She castrates pigs. Oh, and also deletes tweets. We'll talk about that. Speaking of deleting tweets, the new Benghazi. You know, and I said this, and I'll talk more about it later in the program because we've got to rush. But I said this yesterday on the 3 to 6 show, Ring of Fire, that this is the perfect scandal for the Republican Party. They've had to move off the VA, and I'm going to be talking with Paul Rykoff about the VA and Bergdahl later on the program later today on 3 to 6. But they had to move off the VA scandal because that was actually a scandal which involved something that you could fix and do something for people. There is, I don't know necessarily what the solution is, but there is actually a solution to it. You can come to an agreement like, okay, we need to do X, Y, and Z to fix it. There's different policy decisions. Republicans would love to privatize the whole thing and destroy the VA system. But nevertheless, there's actually a substantive real world answer for it. For this, there is none. It is just scandal mongering. So this is perfect for them, this Bergdahl thing. Because it will just go on and on and on. A house could fall on Bergdahl and those five Taliban prisoners who were exchanged, and it would still continue to go on and on. So we'll talk more about that. And also this whole thing about hurricanes. Apparently, they have studied the implications of naming hurricanes, and it reveals just sort of how deeply embedded our gender discrimination is. We'll talk more about that, but first, Ian Millhiser. We'll be right back.
I turn my camera on.
days. And you was the night. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ian Millhiser. He is a senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. Ian, welcome to the program.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much.
So, Ian, this is going to be a particular, I guess every June we sort of feel this way, but this is going to be a, there's going to be, you note seven big cases that the Supreme Court is going to decide in June, assuming that there's no extra special circumstances which push their decisions into July. You write, could change America, and I got to agree. We're facing some really hugely important cases. Let's start with recess appointments. What's the case and what are the implications going to be?
Sure. So this is the Noel Canning case that, you know, gotten a fair amount of press. And the issue here is that several years ago, President Obama recess appointed several people to the National Labor Relations Board. And if you're not familiar with the NLRB, the NLRB has the exclusive authority to enforce much of our labor law. So your right to join the union, your right to organize with other workers, your right to complain about your work condition to other workers, your right, if you belong to a union, to have your employer actually bargain with that union and not just hold out and refuse to bargain. There's this whole group of rights that if the NLRB isn't able to operate, those rights cease to exist. So Republicans have refused for a while to confirm anyone to these NLRB seats. If no one was confirmed to these seats, the NLRB would shut down and all of these rights would stop functioning.
All right, let me just stop you there. That's because you need a quorum on the NLRB basically what the Republicans were doing is akin to nullification, right? I mean, they did a similar thing with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They don't have a problem with specific nominees per se. They just have a problem with the existence of the actual statutorily required entity.
That's right. I mean, what they've done is they found a loophole in federal law where there's these union rights that conservatives typically don't like. There's this agency that they typically don't like that enforces these rights. And so they can't repeal all of these union rights unless they control Congress. But if they can prevent anyone from being confirmed to this agency, and if President Obama does, or whoever the president is, doesn't have the power to cut that off at the recess appointment, then it's like you had all of the union rights that have existed since the Roosevelt administration just stopped. So the punchline here is that there actually are now five confirmed people on the NLRB during one of the fights that eventually led to the nuclear option and the end of the filibuster for most nominees. Five people were confirmed. So we have a stay of execution right now. But if the Supreme Court cuts off the recess appointment power, and it is likely to do so, although I think the administration is probably going to lose this case, then come 2018, when these NLRB seats are up again, we're going to have this fight all over again. And if Republicans control the Senate, they're once again going to have the power to shut down all of America's labor law unless the president has the power to use recess appointments to cut that off.
Now, with this case, I mean, is this deal with just the existence of recess appointments or the mechanism or the way that the administration interpreted their recess appointment powers?
It is a surprisingly technical case. So the issue here is that the Senate was holding these sham sessions.
Right.
They're called pro forma sessions, where literally a single senator would show up. They'd hit the gavel once, say the Senate is now in session. They'd hit the gavel again, say the Senate is not in session, is no longer in session. And the argument was that if they held one of these sham sessions every 3 days, that was enough to defeat President Obama's ability to make recess appointments.
So this doesn't
strike
down the concept of recess appointments. It just basically says that effectively, if you control the Senate, there will be no recess.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there's another rationale that's probably not going to prevail, but I think that what the Supreme Court's probably going to say is that whoever controls the Senate has the ability to, if they want, eliminate recesses, and in doing so, eliminate the recess appointment power.
And so the real issue becomes, I guess, back in, 2018, it could, oh, I see. So it's not just the NLRB, though, right? I mean, wouldn't this be subject to any, if they control the Senate in 20, after, I guess, come January of 2015, there may be not just the NLRB, which would be more of an issue in 2018 when the appointments come up, but it could theoretically be for a whole host of agencies.
It could, although the NLRB, you know, I don't want to say it's unique, but it's very unusual in that the Supreme Court has said that unless there's at least three people who sit on the NLRB, that three of the five board members, then the agency is completely powerless. That's what the Supreme Court has said. And that's not true about most agencies. The Senate refused to confirm an attorney general, for example, then the deputy attorney general can carry out those duties. If there's no deputy attorney general, then, like, there are people down the line in DOJ who can be acting attorneys general until the Senate gets the program. But if the Senate refuses to confirm people to the NLRB, there's no way you could have a deputy board member or an acting board member or someone else step up to take their place. So the NLRB is unusual in that regard, in that it actually can be shut down, and with it, much of our federal labor law can be shut down if people aren't confirmed.
That sounds just lovely. So, and of course, that may be something down the road that we might want to change statutorily, right? I mean, that's a function of the National Labor Relations Act.
That's right. I mean, there's nothing that prevents Congress from saying, you know, they could say that if no one's been confirmed, then the terms of the existing board members are extended. They could say that, you know, there's the president's the power to appoint acting appointees. You know, there are ways around it. Congress just hasn't done that yet.
Okay. Let's move to harassment at women's health clinics. This centers around a Massachusetts law which creates a 35-foot buffer zone around the entrances of abortion clinics so that women who are attempting to go in for abortion services or presumably any other family planning services basically don't have to have people shoving images of bloody tissue in their face.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, this is an experience that I think, unfortunately, you know, many women who have been to women's health centers, and not necessarily for abortions, you know, they may be there for a pap smear, but, you know, many women who go to these clinics encounter a ring of protesters surrounding them. And, you know, the protests take different forms. You know, in some cases, it's very nice old ladies who want to walk up to the women and talk to them about why they don't like abortion. And in other cases, there have been bombings. There have been acid attacks. There have been, the most extreme cases, there have been abortion doctors who have been murdered. So there's the full range of people who are acting very peacefully to people who are acting very violently, who sometimes participate in abortion protests. And in this case, the state of Massachusetts said, we're going to create a buffer zone. It's 35 feet around the entrance to an abortion clinic where these protesters are not allowed to enter. So there's a zone of safety for the women trying to get into these clinics. You know, based on the oral argument, the court seems likely to strike this Massachusetts law down. I think there was some concerns even from Justice Kagan, who's, you know, normally a friend of liberal causes, that 35 feet was too much. But that's not the biggest issue in this case. The biggest issue is that Justice Kennedy and several of the other conservatives have wanted to eliminate all buffer zones altogether around abortion clinics. And so, you know, that would mean you couldn't have a 10-foot buffer zone. You could have a 1-foot buffer zone. You know, no matter what, if you're trying to get into a Planned Parenthood clinic, even if you're there for birth control pills, people will be able to come up to you and harass you, and states won't be able to take the preventative measure.
And so what is the on what grounds would they say that you can't do this? I mean, it seems to me we have free speech zones all over the place when there's any type of situation. That seems to be sort of a regular occurrence now.
Yeah, I mean, the argument is that, you know, and it's a clever argument, if not necessarily one that I buy, is that if you let the people who work at the clinic in, presumably those are people who support abortion rights, whereas if you don't let the protesters come near the clinic, those are people who oppose abortion rights, and so that's a kind of viewpoint discrimination.
Oh, my God.
You know, I don't buy. Yeah. I mean, I don't buy that argument because, you know, that's, first of all, that's not how the statute's drafted. You know, the statute doesn't, you know, if the statute said people who oppose abortion aren't allowed to do this, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to discriminate because of someone's viewpoint. But what the law says is it says that no one is allowed into this buffer zone unless they're there for certain reasons. So if they're there to, because they have business in the clinic, if they're there because they work in the clinic, or if they're just passing by on their way to another place of business. So it's not key to a person's viewpoint. You know, you can be pro-choice, and if you're not someone with legitimate business in that clinic, you're not supposed to go into this buffer zone.
Right, and theoretically, you could be anti-abortion and go in for a pap smear.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and there probably are women who oppose abortion who nonetheless patronize, I know that there are, who nonetheless patronize Planned Parenthood clinics and the like because they want pap smears and they want birth control as well.
All right. So this is one of those, I guess, elections have consequences type of situation because, if you're picketing outside, if you're a union, you're picketing, right? There's a distance that you have to be from the entrance of a business.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon. I mean, there's even a case on point that was pretty close to being on point, dealing with protesters who would actually show up at the homes of the people they were protesting. So rather than protesting the business, they would show up and set up with a bunch of signs outside of someone's house. And the Supreme Court said that, you know, the First Amendment doesn't let you do that. So, you know, our First Amendment gives us a right to, you know, say what we want to say, not be discriminated against. But there are all kinds of examples where, something for entirely legitimate reasons, we're not allowed to say what we want to say in the exact location that we want to say it. You know, I can disagree with President Obama all I want, but if I claim that I have the right to barge into the Oval Office whenever I want and tell it to his face, No, I don't have that right. You know, the law can set reasonable limitations on where I can do things.
Wow. That case just seems wacko to me. But let's move to public sector unions because, one of the cases that I think got very little attention and should have gotten a lot more, I guess this was now 2 years ago, was Knox v. SEIU.
Right.
And this is, tell us about this case and then tell us about how, Harris v. Quinn sort of, completes this, project in, attempting to really, really inhibit, unions' ability to function in many respects.
Right. So Knox placed restrictions on how unions can raise money and, you know, especially for political purposes. But it also included this section that, you know, has very serious implications for many unions' ability to continue to exist. So, like, the way that the law works governing unions is that if you work in a unionized shop, that union has to represent you and has to bargain on your behalf, regardless of whether or not you are a member of that union. So, you know, you can be a non-member in a unionized shop, and you get the union bargains so that you get higher wages, too. They bargain so that you get better benefits, too. And any job benefits that the union members get, the non-member also is entitled to that benefit. The union's not allowed to discriminate in that way. But if you just had that rule where the union has to bargain on behalf of its non-members and that was it, you'd have a huge free rider problem. You know, if I'm a worker in a unionized shop, what's my incentive to pay union dues if I get all the benefits of being in a union, all the higher wages, and all the increased benefits for free without having to pay the dues at all?
Let me just stop you here for 1 second. We should remind people, I mean, this should go without saying, but you're not in that situation unless the majority of the workers at that, whatever it is you're working at, that firm you're working at, have gone through a very extended process of petitioning to get elections, then having elections, withstanding all of the attempts by the management to influence those elections. So the elections have already happened. You're one of those people who didn't want the union. You don't want to join the union, but the union is representing you anyways. And so you got this free rider problem. All right, I just wanted to make that clear to everybody.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I point out that, you know, at least according to one study, unionization raises your worker wages by about 12%. So your wage is going to be 12% higher if you're in on average, if you're in a union shop as opposed to if you're in a non-union shop. And like I said, the non-members get that too. But the price of them getting the benefit is that the unions are typically allowed to charge what are called agency fees. And agency fees are just the price that the union charges its non-members that it bargains on behalf of so that they are getting some compensation for the work that they're putting in on behalf of the non-members. You know, bargaining can be expensive. It can require expensive lawyers. It can require very sophisticated contract negotiators. And the union has to recoup the cost of that bargaining, of hiring those lawyers and those contract negotiators. And so it's allowed to charge the non-members who benefit from higher union wages a reasonable fee. These are the agency fees. What this new case, Harris v. Quinn, wants to do is it wants to declare those agency fees unconstitutional, at least as applied to public sector unions. There was language in the Knox case, the case we were discussing earlier, which hinted that the Supreme Court, or at least the five conservative justices, are very eager to do this. So if Knox goes down against the unions, what it's going to mean is you're going to have, in at least all of your public sector unions, a tremendous free rider problem where people can get all kinds of unionization benefits without having to pay for them, which is going to mean that it's going to be very difficult for unions to continue to raise the money they need in order to continue existing.
Right. It basically creates a death spiral for the unions. And we should say that to the extent that there's any unionization left in this country, it is primarily in the public sector. I mean, I think it's 7% in the private sector and significantly higher in the public sector. So this is really... Go ahead. No, you, please.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, it's many times higher. I mean, you know, the public sector is where unions are continuing to thrive in many cases. If this case comes down against the unions, it's going to be a disaster for unionization generally. I'll say one more thing, which is a bit surprising, which was that at oral arguments, Justice Scalia, who is normally not a friend of liberals of any kind, seemed to understand that, oh, yeah, there's a free rider problem here, and he seemed sympathetic to a lot of the union's arguments. So it's possible that we can get a 5-4 decision with Scalia casting the key vote to save the unions here. I don't know that I want to bet on that, but, you know, if the unions manage to pull this one out, the justice who's going to save them, it looks like, is going to be Scalia.
Now, how does that happen? I mean, what... I find it surprising that, well, and terrifying that we're hoping that Scalia, but what and is the savior here? I mean, what is it ideologically that brings him to this place? Because he's not typically, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not sure what your opinion is of this, but I think it's become clearer and clearer that Scalia and you've written as much, and we'll tease that for your next appearance. But Scalia very often, it seems to me, starts with where he wants to get to and then it figures out a way of getting there. Maintaining public sector unionization rates does not seem to be a place he wants to get to. Why is it that he might be one of the guys? Why might he be the swing?
It's a good question. I mean, Scalia surprises us every few years. There was a case several years ago where he saved part of New York's banking law, and, you know, no one expected that to happen. There, you know, was a case more recently where he struck down an Arizona law that tried to make it harder for people to vote. So every now and then, he does the right thing. And, you know, my theory on why, and this isn't so much a defense of Scalia as it is a warning about the younger generation of conservative lawyers, but, you know, for most of American history, the Supreme Court has been a force of evil. You know, I actually have a book coming out called The Case Against the Supreme Court that lays this out in some detail. But, you know, for, you know, the Supreme Court decided Dred Scott, the Supreme Court paved the road for Jim Crow, the Supreme Court spent most of the early 20th century striking down all kinds of laws designed to protect workers. The Supreme Court has not been a force of good for most of American history. And then you had this unusual period when Earl Warren was Chief Justice, and for a few years afterwards, where the Supreme Court, you know, was, you know, handing down a lot of progressive decisions. And I think that that messed with conservatives' heads, where, you know, in the immediate wake of the Warren era, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, you had all of these conservatives who were so freaked out, especially about Roe v. Wade, but about the idea that the Supreme Court could be liberal at all, that they embraced a kind of conservative judicial restraint that some of them still cling to every now and then. Mm-hmm. You know, Scalia used to be very vocal in support of judicial restraint, even if he doesn't act that way. So my point is simply that amongst the older conservative justices, occasionally there's this thread of judicial restraint that comes out, and we don't see that in the younger generation. The younger generation of conservative lawyers, you know, many of them want to go back to the bad old days when child labor laws were unconstitutional. But among some of the older conservatives, every now and then they'll think, well, you know, I really don't like Roe, and I really don't like all these things that the Warren Court did, and that was judges overreaching, so maybe I should be careful about overreaching as well.
Interesting. And maybe he just goes and he spins some type of roulette wheel to decide which case he's going to decide where he will not be, where he will exercise that restraint, or that's interesting. And we have time for one more. I mean, I will talk about the stuff that you've written about the viability of treaties and cell phone searches. But let's just finally touch on the Halby lobby case, because this, of course, got a lot of attention during the oral arguments. This is a case where there is a requirement in the Affordable Care Act that companies must provide health insurance for their employees, or go to, or basically pay a tax. And additionally, there is a requirement by the Affordable Care Act that insurance companies offer to basically qualify as health insurance. They offer free contraception contraception payments, I guess. And Hobby Lobby Take it from there, because Hobby Lobby is ostensibly a secular company, I guess. I mean, they sell craft services, right? I mean, they're not
right.
They're not providing, I don't know, mass for people or what, or you know, they're not doing bar mitzvahs. They're not a religious. They don't provide religious services. Yet they're arguing that the company has religious beliefs.
No, that's right. It's a for-profit company. It's basically the Walmart of crafting. You know, there are these big box stores that have all kinds of crafting supplies, but their owners are very religious, and their owners object to certain forms of birth control. And so their argument is that because the owners of the company have religious objections here, those religious objections should trump the federal rules requiring them to provide birth control to their employees. You know, I have two things to say about this case. One is that this is not how we have understood religious liberty in the past in this country. The way that the Supreme Court has understood it for as long as we've really had a viable concept of religious liberty is essentially that my religious liberty stops at your body. So I have, you know, a robust ability to go about and do what I want to do with my own life and in accordance with my own faith, and the government doesn't have any business stepping on that until I try to use my religious liberty as a sword to take away your rights or to take away someone else's rights. And once someone tries to do that, the Supreme Court has historically said no. You don't get to not provide someone with a benefit you're required to by law. You don't get to hurt someone because of your religious belief. You do not get to impose your religious belief on others. So this case could potentially tear down that wall. And then the other point that I will make is that there have been many examples in the past of people wanting to do really scary things if that wall was torn down. You know, this case is about birth control. There have been past Supreme Court cases dealing with the minimum wage where people didn't want to pay the minimum wage and they claimed they had a religious objection, where they didn't want to pay Social Security taxes and they claimed they had a religious objection. And then the big one is anti-discrimination law. You know, if you go back to the Jim Crow era, there were people who called, there was one former governor of the state of Mississippi who called God the original segregationist. You know, these people would link racism and their religious faith. And there was a Supreme Court case called Bob Jones saying, no, you don't get to do that.
And Bob Jones, we're talking about Bob Jones University, where they wouldn't allow interracial dating. I mean,
that's right. And they claimed they were justified in doing it because it was their religious beliefs and the law, those religious beliefs trumped anti-discrimination law. And the Supreme Court said no dice. You know, there have been cases in the past where people want to discriminate against women because of their religious beliefs, and the courts have said no dice. And, of course, the big looming issue, especially with these bills being proposed in states like Arizona, is people who want to discriminate against gay people and whether or not their religious beliefs give them the right to say, well, because we object to the fact that this person is gay, we don't have to follow the law saying we can't discriminate against them. So if the Supreme Court tears down this wall, which says that my religious liberty stops at your body, that could have very scary implications moving forward and could potentially threaten this understanding that says that you can't use religion to discriminate and you can't use religion to deny people their rights.
And you would probably, you would definitely have a better sense than I, but I would also think that depending on how this case is decided, and not just in terms of whether or not Hobby Lobby wins or loses, but in terms of how what is sort of the rationale behind it, it seems to me that the next step is, well, I've got religious liberty, and then I've also got free speech, and that this is ultimately going to be part of a larger edifice which is going to make government regulation on corporations that much harder in the future, basically on like things like First Amendment grounds, right? I mean, it seems to me this is part of a larger project to get rid of government regulation writ large.
Yeah, it's definitely true that, like, especially in the religious liberty space, there's an effort for conservatives to build a firewall against battles that they know that they are going to lose. You know, there was a document published shortly after President Obama took office called the Manhattan Declaration that laid this whole theory out in a fair amount of detail. And, you know, what a lot of religious conservatives are saying now, they know they're going to lose on marriage equality. You know, they know that there are a lot of these cultural battles that they've been fighting for a very long time that they are going to lose, period. And so their strategy is to make them and their communities an island unto themselves and make it so that when they lose these battles, the battles that they lose during the general course of our democracy, those losses don't apply to them. You know, if there's a law saying that says that they can't discriminate against a gay person, that law won't apply to them. If there's a law in this case saying that they're required to provide contraception, that law won't apply to them. It's an effort to exempt themselves essentially from the functionings of our democracy.
Ian Millhiser, we're out of time, but I want to have you back on when your book comes out. It sounds fascinating, and I will catch over due course. So we will obviously be talking about these cases. We'll probably have you back in June when these are resolved in one fashion or another. But certainly we want to discuss your book as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and I'll be back with Adam Green to catch us up from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee on the success and or failures of progressive candidates in the primary last night around the country. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Adam Green, one of the co-founders of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, an organization that I think does fantastic work in finding progressive candidates early, supporting them not just financially, but basically, you know, providing them a path to victory, which develops long-term relationships so that they govern in that way, too. Elizabeth Warren is one of the great examples of a candidate who was championed early by the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and she has been one of those true blue progressives when it comes at least to things like financial reform and inequality in this country. Adam Green, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. I think you just gave the Progressive Change Campaign Committee's elevator pitch more succinctly and correctly than I ever have. So
I was just going to apologize for basically taking up all your time with your intro.
Just ditto what you said.
Well, now, so let's talk about, you've got to get to a conference call with the media because there were some very big exciting wins. I mean, look, we're not going to take the Democrats are not going to take Congress back, and certainly progressives are not going to take the Congress in the short term. But it's very possible we could be seeing something different in the years to come. So we want as many progressives in there as possible. Let's start east to west. New Jersey.
Yeah. So first, before we go east to west, you know, last night a lot of TV focused on this battle on the Republican side between the Tea Party and the establishment, right? But there really is a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party happening right now as well between the Elizabeth Warren wing and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And there's a bunch of open Democratic seats or vulnerable Republicans on the ballot this year. And we're engaging in these battles to make sure that we elect real progressives. So, yeah, in New Jersey, Rush Holt, great progressive, retired, and Bonnie Watson Coleman, former Assembly Majority Leader, current Assemblywoman, one of Chris Christie's biggest critics, was a bold progressive in that race. And she actively campaigned, including in her paid advertising, on the idea of protecting and expanding Social Security and Medicare. Also talked about raising taxes on millionaires to pay for educational investment and investing in jobs. And this was a big race that we were heavily involved with. We literally helped her set up her campaign the first week. And thousands of our members donated to her campaign, made thousands of phone calls for her campaign. We placed staffers on the ground. And last night, she had a really big victory. And she will likely go on to win the seat easily in November. And it's great to have an actual progressive there, endorsed by us and many members of the Progressive Caucus.
And she is making some history, I guess, in New Jersey. I mean, it's been a while, right?
First woman since a
congresswoman from New Jersey, I think over 10 years.
Over 10 years, and the first African-American woman to be elected in New Jersey, my home state.
Is that your home state? I had no idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great. That's great news. And all right, so let's keep moving east to west.
Sounds good. So have you ever heard of any political significance in Iowa?
What is it that goes on in Iowa? Well,
something.
I know
something
it's not just about corn, although that's a big issue. Iowa, of course, is where we establish maybe who's going to be president.
Exactly.
Oh, and hog castration, too, right?
Exactly. that'll be a fun Senate race. I think it just got a little bit more fun thanks to that lady winning. But, in a very important open seat, Bruce Braley, who's running for Senate against castration lady. What's her name again?
Ernst.
Right. Ernst. Okay. So he's moving up to run for that, and there was a very active five-way primary to take his place. And once again, a very populist former Speaker of the House, current member of the House, Pat Murphy, was on the ballot, running on his record of raising the minimum wage in Iowa, bringing into Iowa pre-K, universal pre-K education, running on bold ideas like expanding Social Security benefits. And he also had a really big win last night. And he, attended our candidate training. Once again, thousands of folks chipped into his campaign, made thousands of phone calls for him. And, he's going to be a great partner for us in there. The fact that he is from Iowa should not be lost in anybody thinking about running for president.
And when you have a strong progressive, this is a good time to break this down. When you're talking about off-year elections, you need candidates who are going to inspire the progressive base to go out and vote. You need people who are going to give a proactive reason to vote rather than the boogeymen are coming, because the right always sees more boogeymen. And so they're going to come out. So when you have people coming out to vote for Pat Murphy, that's also going to help Braley in his race against the woman who brags about castrating pigs.
Yes. I mean, there will be a very highly energized niche of pig castrators out for her. And we need equal and opposite on our side. And we do that by, castrating corporate power and things like that.
Ooh.
So Bruce Braley is actually the head of the populist caucus in the House. So it's really great that we have a populist at the head of the ticket there. Pat Murphy was able to win because he inspired lots of people to come out and vote for him. And that's what we're seeing across the nation. I mean, turnout, it's not just a matter of taking a poll and seeing where people fall. it's actually getting supporters out to the polls in race after race after race. So,
and so, and I got to say, the castrating the corporate agenda, I would rush down to the patent office with that right now, or the trademark office. let's move.
You can hear more about that at castratingthecorporatepoweragenda.net. It's a new website.
If there is someone at the PCCC right now who is not registering castrating corporate power for that that race in Iowa, that is political malpractice. I'm sure there is. It's probably like
valuable,
it's probably like a competition right now in the PCCC offices to to get that URL. All right, so let's go to all the way. I guess we're going all the way out west now.
All the way out west, not so far as Hawaii, where there actually is another very important primary happening in August, where Brian Schatz is on the ballot against a more conservative primary challenger for Senate. But almost all the way out west in California, a similar situation, great progressive congressman Mike Honda, one of the folks who stood with Alan Grayson to say, we will not vote for any bill, no matter what's in it, if it cuts Social Security benefits, one of the first out of the gate to embrace expanding Social Security benefits, a movement that we've talked about many times here. He was being primaried from the right by a corporate Democrat who got lots of money and started off with $1 million cash advantage over the incumbent progressive congressperson. And this guy had said that he would be potentially willing to cut Social Security for future beneficiaries. Well, that didn't turn out to be a very winning game plan. And he lost big last night. Mike Honda had almost a 2-to-1 advantage over this guy and goes into the general election with the wind at his back. They actually will face each other again due to California's quirky jungle primary where the top two go to the next round. But if we see anything in the general election like we did last night, it will once again be a huge margin for Mike Honda. And that's why, and this was a very strategically important race for progressives to win because we just couldn't be having a bold progressive congressperson being primaried from the right and losing. That would not be acceptable.
Yes, and California does have a very weird primary system where essentially you don't the parties mix together for the primary. And so we have a problem in California at times where Democrats split the vote, and we have occasions where there really, really should be at the very least a Democrat contesting that race, but there ends up being two Republicans. And so, all right, let's give me a sense of is there a race that was lost or that last night that you're disappointed by? I mean, is there one that sticks out for you that we should note?
There is, and it actually directly relates to the point you were just making with California's weird jungle primary. There was an amazing populist progressive doctor named Lee Rogers who was raising a lot of money and was on the National Party's radar, one of our early endorsements. We actually hadn't been engaged with that race for a while due to the fact that it was just accepted that he was the Democrat. And then you had these kind of two crazy Republicans fighting against each other to be number two. Well, speaking to your turnout point before, they ran ads against each other, these Republicans. They drove people to the polls. By a weird quirk, they both ended up in the top two, and there's now no Democrat on the ballot in this newly open seat that became open after a Republican retired. So that's a real tragedy. It's not, I don't think it's an example of the Democratic message losing or progressive message losing per se. It is, the Democratic Party taking a hit due to this absurd jungle primary law in California that allows things like this to happen.
Let me add one more element to that, and that is that the DCCC, not to be confused with the PCCC, the DCCC is run by a guy who does not, who is not, even in a situation like that, where Lee Rogers is the only real opportunity for a Democrat to place in the top two, put, as far as I understand it, not a dime. Steve Israel basically ignored this race because you've got a candidate who's been endorsed by the Congressional Progressive Caucus, right? I mean, do I have that wrong? I mean, because there's another dynamic that's working here, is that where the PCCC wants to have a Democratic caucus that is reflective of progressive values, the DCCC functions as if, and probably does, wants to have a Democratic caucus that has a healthy dose of corporatist and conservative Democrats.
Yeah, you know, it's a real problem, you know, of our times that we're dealing with. It's partly based on the money and our broken campaign finance system, and it's partly based on a very broken conventional wisdom about where voters are and how to win a majority. You know, to start with that point, you know, we consistently see poll after poll, red state, purple state, blue state, that an Elizabeth Warren-style populist agenda, holding Wall Street accountable, expanding Social Security, taxing the wealthy, paying for massive investments in education and jobs, that stuff is just universally popular. It's not a 50-50 issue. It's not even close to being a 50-50 issue. The idea of cutting Social Security benefits is, you know, maximally popular at about 15% in any state. No more than 15% of the voters support that. So the idea that, you know, somebody is a quote-unquote centrist for wanting to cut Social Security, as they're often defined in the media, is just absurd. They are literally they're out on the fringe, you know, with the 15% or below. But the false conventional wisdom that for some reason a position like that would be moderate, that for some reason Elizabeth Warren's positions aren't the center of the bell curve, is what leads some people to support corporate Democrats. You know, the other reason is that corporate Democrats tend to be able to raise a lot of corporate money.
Right.
Sometimes they sell finance, and folks like Steve Israel incentivize that over values. You know, what that cuts against is, as you said before, people actually being enthusiastic about voting on election day. So it's really unfortunate, and it is something that we're dealing with definitely across the nation.
Adam Green from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. The website is boldprogressives.org.
Boldprogressives.org. Nearly a million folks strong, but we need you. If you agree with anything we're saying today, check out two websites: castratingcorporatepower.net, still available by the way, or boldprogressives.org. And if you're really enthusiastic,
majority.fm.
Majority.fm. I didn't realize you had such an easy one. Okay, there we go. Majority.fm.
Yeah.
Where you can sign up, by the way, to join me as a monthly dues paying member.
It's true. I get IMs from Adam occasionally, like that segment, and I'm always it's always exciting to hear from you that you're listening. Adam, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your work, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
All right, bye-bye. I don't know why he chuckled like that at the end.
He's like, hey.
Yeah. It was weird.
A little sinister.
There was something very sinister about it. Like, he's, like, in the next room or something.
He's, like, this benign, really well-intentioned Machiavellian, which is important. We need people like that.
Yes. Well, I don't know that he's benign.
Well, I mean, benign in terms of he has positive intentions for actual people.
Yes, he's our Machiavelli.
He's our Machiavelli. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
A dues-paying member of the Majority Report Machiavelli.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. We're going to tell you about... Now, I couldn't even keep up with this story with the NRA. I didn't realize how much they had backtracked already. It's unbelievable. And there's just a wonderful photo of one of these guys in a Target. We'll talk about these all-access Texas carry, whatever they're... I have no idea what they... open carry. Seattle... raises the deal has gone through, raises their minimum wage to $15 an hour. I mean, it's actually phased in depending on the size of business you have and what sector you're in. But this is very good news. The mayor championed it, but it was really Kashama Swant who ran as a socialist in that city council fight that really made the mayor adopt that policy and put it through. I mean, it just shows you the value of, well, it shows you a couple of things. The value of having a left flank and also sort of just, I think in many respects, sort of where the body politic is headed. We'll also talk about, of course, we will play the pig castration audio just to recall it. And this horrible report out of Tennessee of a cotton gin boss just spouting all of this racist rhetoric. We know, of course, there's no racism left in America. But it is just, it is sort of shocking to hear the audio of this. We will talk about that. Also, there's a runoff between, well, we'll get into this, the runoff between McDaniel and Cochran. We'll play some of McDaniel's greatest hits. We're going to take a break, folks. It is your membership that keeps this show alive. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes a day. Sometimes, like today, it'll be an extra half hour because we went a little long in the freebie show. But we give you new content every day. And we take your phone calls and your IMs in the funner half of the program. We loosen up a little bit. We take off our ties and our unbutton our top buttons.
Matt removes his dress hoodie.
That's right.
Things get very, very relaxed.
That's right. And it's your way of supporting this program and saying you want it around. I mean, I'm enjoying doing a terrestrial radio, but it is there's a lot of landmines there, folks, that I am trying to avoid on a daily basis. And frankly, I'm not sure at the end of the day that it's worth it. But this program's not going to go anywhere. And frankly, this is the future. But the future involves funding sources that are not coming from, you know, penis extenders, to be honest with you, or gold penis extenders, or any of the like. And the future also does not involve, you know, an owner of a station or a program director who, you know, doesn't like the fact that you're knocking Democrats sometimes. Or knocking President Obama sometimes. That's just a reality. And so this show answers to no one but you. And really, it's you in general. I mean, you as an individual, with all due respect, I'm not going to answer to you specifically. We will answer you, but in other words, we're not going to change what we do if one person has a problem with it. That is the beauty of funding it this way.
And what he's trying to say is more spoilers ahead.
More spoilers. Yeah. So we're going to tell you, we're going to read the Game of Thrones books on air. Folks, you can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Go there. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there. You will notice no difference. It costs you nothing, but for the 30 seconds it takes you to set up, and we get a kickback, every little bit helps. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment.
Just taking off my hoodie.
Oh, wow. That didn't sound like that.
I was trying to grab something.
All right, go ahead.